This is Car Expert.
Once you've done all those things like taking the doors and the roof and the windscreen off, it totally comes into its own.
The concept also appeared in The Avengers, even though it had a petrol engine noise when he drove it. It's electric.
There's a whole lot of little things they've done to this car that make it look more like a Q7.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. Joining me this week is Scott Colley.
G'day, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hey, Mandy, I'm getting really sick of you always introducing me last. It reminds me of school when I was always at the bottom of the roll because my surname starts with W. I'm sick of it.
Mandy is a known okay. stickler for doing things alphabetically.
No, so am I.
Will this make you feel better? Hello, James Wong.
Hey, Mandy.
Hello, Scott Colley.
Mandy, can you not do me last, please?
Now, I heard that you guys went go-karting with the Car Expert team last night. How did that go?
Depends on who you ask.
Oh.
Mandy, it went very, very well. Very well.
Oh, dear. Let me guess, you won, Scully.
Well, I was the fastest in our first session. I wasn't the fastest in our second session, but my time was the fastest of the night. And I actually am going to have to leave now because I have an interview with Ron Dennis. We're talking like McLaren stuff for next year, even though he doesn't work there anymore. So this has been fun, but I'm out of here. Thanks very much.
Drop the mic.
I walked out of that session actually giving Scott the nickname Billy Ray Cyrus because he was a bit of a one-hit wonder. He went from first to last within the space of, 15 minutes? It was a lot of fun though. We went to the Ace Karts in Sunshine, and it's an outdoor track that's quite technical and a bit longer. You got some cool corners and it's a bit of fun. We had in our two sessions, the first one was actually quite crowded. So for those of us who were able to break away from the group of young men that were more busy trying to play dodgem cars rather than actually race each other, which is probably why Scott got the best time because I was at the back of the pack and had to weave my way through, and I thought that showed more talent. But, it was a real
loser chat from back there.
Yeah, no. In the briefing, I was waiting for them to tell us how to throw the bananas and green shells, but, we didn't get to that part. Might have helped.
Just quickly, if Billy Ray Cyrus was a motorsports guy, he would have one hit and it would be called Achy Breaky Cut.
Oh.
There you go.
Slow clap.
And in 20 years, you'll be singing something along the lines of Old Town Road, right?
Exactly, just to stay relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
How did the rest of the team fare? Who else was racing?
So Albors is down in Melbourne at the moment, and he and Paul duked it out for second and third place. Paul was the second quickest in the second session behind Albors. They were about 3/10 off the pace. And then Moko and Jaywo and Igor were all very close as well. Igor second quickest in the first session. Maybe suffered a dodgy cart like I did in the second session. Who knows? Not making excuses, just making excuses. But it was all very tight. I think there was no more than about a second in it for the whole group. So if nothing else, we know the Car Expert team is consistent.
It sounds like you guys had a lot of fun. All right. Well, we'll get stuck into this week's show now. Time for this week's car news. Jaywo, the electric Jeep Wrangler, has been teased.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool thing, isn't it? So Jeep has already started its electrification process with the Wrangler, which is, an old school rugged off-roader, and they revealed a plug-in hybrid a while ago, and now they're teasing an all-electric version. So we don't know too much about it yet, but it will be revealed at the Easter Jeep Safari, which is an annual event that they do in Utah, and this year it's being held from March 27th to April 4th. So expect it to make its debut officially sometime around then. So it looks pretty much like a Wrangler, like every other Wrangler. So the main changes obviously will be underneath. So instead of your conventional petrol or diesel engines, you'll find a fully electric system underneath with motors, batteries and all that. But we don't know any of the specs yet. And also expect it to be properly good off-road because it's a Wrangler and it needs to be that way. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with that, because I'm assuming Jeep will accelerate the EV version or the EV development for Wrangler, because we've seen a few other American companies really get on the all-electric off-roader or, you know, commercial vehicle sort of thing. So you got like Rivian who's now on its way to starting to sell its new electric SUV and ute, which are fairly capable in terms of like towing capacity and off-road ability. So it's no surprise that Jeep's going down the same path. But yeah, at the moment we don't know any specs. We do know stuff about the plug-in hybrid, but that's sort of not really relevant when we're talking about the all-electric version, right? So yeah, it's a very like wait and see sort of thing.
I think what's really exciting about this electric Jeep is that it's the first Jeep, but sort of one of the early Fiat Chrysler electric cars, that's actually been designed as an EV that they want to build. The first 500 electric car was a car that Sergio Marchionne said, please don't buy it. We lose money on it. I hate it, basically. But we're now seeing a really beautiful reinterpretation of the Fiat 500. That's all electric in Europe. And when we spoke to Jeep's chief designer last year, his name's Mark Allen, he said that we're not doing this grudgingly. We're not doing it because we have to. We think we can make an even better Jeep with motors on every axle that can do all sorts of stuff that a petrol car maybe might not be able to. So I actually really like the idea of Jeep and Fiat Chrysler in general taking charge of electric vehicle development and doing it from a place of passion and using the strengths of electric vehicles to make their traditional heroes better rather than just doing it for the sake. And I think this Wrangler could really be something special.
It could end up changing off-roading experiences as well. Instead of having the petrol or the diesel to try and get you out of trouble, an electric car would do it much easier if there's a motor on each wheel and more torque at less revs. So it only can be a good thing.
Exactly. I mean, you've just got low range all the time.
Yeah, that's it. And also speaking of off-road vehicles, Scully, the Land Rover Defender Works has revealed the V8 Trophy, and oh boy, do I want one.
How cool does it look? It's a really, really limited project. So Land Rover and Jaguar has the same sort of thing. It's like a little Skunk Works part of the company that takes some really cool classics and some really cool modern cars, puts kind of silly engines in them and does them up to a crazy level, and then sells them for just huge amounts of money to customers who want to feel all nostalgic and buy a working old Land Rover, which is quite hard to do sometimes. So these ones are based on the Camel Trophy Defenders that raced in all sorts of crazy off-road challenges. There's some beautiful, iconic images from the Camel Trophy of like lines of yellow Defenders stuck in the mud with people out trying to, you know, fix them on the move. And it's a really cool event sponsored by cigarettes, because that was what motorsport used to be. These new ones won't be raced in that same series, but they will be raced in a 3-day trophy event at the East Nor Castle in Herefordshire, where Land Rover does a lot of its off-road testing. Under the bonnet is a 5-litre supercharged V8, and it is making 298 kilowatts of power and 515 newton meters of torque, and there's a ZF 8-speed automatic transmission. So these aren't Defenders of old, even though they're in old bodies. There's no rattly 2.5-litre engine in there. These are properly quick cars with a modern Jaguar Land Rover motor under the bonnet. You can even get it as a shorty, but it does come at a cost. How much do you think you would pay for one of these?
Oh, boy.
£150,000.
£150,000? You are £45,000 short.
Wow.
So okay. Based on the current exchange rate for a 90 in the UK, you're looking at $350,000. And that is a lot of money for a classic Defender, as cool as this is.
Wow. The amount of money that these, I don't know, would you call this a recreation?
Yeah.
Like, sort of like what Aston and Jag do?
It's like a resto mod of sorts, I guess, yeah.
God, they fetch a lot of money.
I think
it's just
the challenge with them is that because you're making things in such low volumes, one of the reasons that you can make cars cheap is because you can make a lot of them. So you can order a million indicator switches for a Kia Cerato or even a modern Defender, because eventually you will build that many cars. But if you're making 25 cars, by the time you've sourced them, done what's actually needed to bring them into line, made all the unique parts, done all the engineering, the cost of that isn't broken up over 5 or 6 or 7 million global sales. It's broken up across 25 wealthy people in the British countryside, and they've got to pay for it. So it's just, I mean, I'm very glad these things exist, but yeah, purely because of their scale, they are always going to be very, very expensive.
Mm, good points you make there. Jambo, when I first saw the reveal of the 2021 Audi e-tron GT, I actually thought it was a concept. It looks incredible.
Yes, so we've been waiting for this car for a while, and like you said, it does look like a concept car because they've pretty much redone the concept car that they revealed a few years ago and made it a production model. So the 2021 Audi e-tron GT is essentially Audi's version of the Porsche Taycan. It's going to be offered in two versions, the e-tron GT and the RS e-tron GT, both of which getting different power trains, in the sense that one will be, you know, a measly 350 kilowatt and 630 newton meter combined output, and then the RS version will have 440 kilowatts and 830 newton meters, so about the same as what you'd expect from like an RS6 or RS7. And both cars have overboost mode, so the base car in overboost mode produces 390 kilowatts and the RS version is 475. 0 to 100, which seems to be a very standard measure for electric cars these days because everybody's chasing the quickest sprint times. The base car can do a 4.1 second sprint to 100, and the RS drops that to about 3.3 seconds. So not quite Tesla fast, but they're still very, very fast. And both cars use a 93 kilowatt hour battery, lithium ion battery pack, with 85 kilowatt hours of that being usable capacity, and they're capable of 270 kilowatt DC fast charging. In Scott's story, which is very comprehensive as usual, and you know, great job, Scott.
I'm holding a gun to JWo's head, threatening if he doesn't say that this is a hostage situation.
Oh, there's just so much going on. No, there's this really cool graphic that Scott's inserted into the story that sort of has like a slider that shows you the concept that then sort of transforms into the production car. And it's just incredible at how close they made this car to the concept. For those who don't know, the concept also appeared in the Avengers. It was Tony Stark's vehicle of choice, even though it had a petrol engine noise when he drove it. It's electric. So just keep that in mind.
Attention to detail, I'm not so great there.
Yeah, you know, we love a comic. And the even though the outside is quite concept car looking, the interior is very typical Audi. So you've got your virtual cockpit, you've got a high set infotainment touchscreen with the latest MMI interface, you've got comfortable chairs that are electrically adjustable, all that kind of stuff. We don't know too much about what it's going to include a standard and all that here yet because it's not due for a little while. It's coming here in the third quarter of 2021. So it's about a year and a half behind the Porsche. But it looks great. It's also not as fast as the top spec Taycan, if I remember correctly. Doesn't the Taycan have a turbo version that's like a sub 3 second dash to triple figures? I think that's right.
The Taycan Turbo S is slightly faster, but I also think in a lot of the build up to the launch of this car and in the name GT, obviously, Audi has pitched this as a slightly more comfortable, longer range kind of cruiser than the Taycan, although they're both limited by their battery size, obviously. So I think the fact that, I mean, for one, it's still ridiculously rudely fast is obviously going to make people happy. But what Audi is really pushing for here and why it's a little bit more classic in its proportions than the Taycan, which is quite futuristic, is because Audi wants it to be the slightly slower, slightly more comfortable, but still very capable grand touring option. I wonder if maybe at some point there'll be an RS e-tron GT Performance or Performance Plus or something like that that will really take on the Taycan, because Audi does tend to do that later in a car's life. They add more performance again. So maybe we'll get our Taycan Turbo S in what I think is a more attractive package. I love the body of that Audi, but we might have to wait a little while for it.
On the topic of range, it claims to cover up to 488 kilometres on the WLTP test cycle, and it's going to be produced alongside the Audi R8 at the Bollinger factory in, Nykarlsholm.
So we spent a lot of time talking with Audi about this car in the lead up, and no matter how many times I heard them say it, I couldn't get it right. I'm going to give it a crack. It was Bollinger Höfe in Nykarlsholm. I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That one.
That sounds right.
that sounds pretty close. So I'll just roll this totally smoke. Just whenever, this whenever turned into Duolingo. Yeah, whenever I want to say the factory name, I just need you to paste the audio clip of Scott saying that about 10 seconds ago.
And lastly, just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how Lotus is retiring the Elise, the Exige, and Evora. But now, Scully, we have seen what the 2021 Elise and Exige final edition's going to look like.
And they look fantastic. Lotus knows how to do a special edition to keep the Elise and the Exige fresh for as long as they have. They essentially just keep adding more performance bits to them, but also more interesting exterior finishes, interior trims, that sort of thing. And this is meant to be the culmination of both those cars. So they've gone all out. For all of these final editions, there are a couple of different models. I actually think the most appealing of all of them is the Elise Sport 240, because you can get it in a beautiful blue that was one of the original colors for the car. But it's been boosted by 20 horsepower, so it's got more grunt than the base Elise Sport 220. It comes with all sorts of cool stuff, like a really cool set of staggered wheels wrapped in Yokohama V105 tires. You can also... because, I mean, 922 kilos is just so heavy by modern standards. You can order it with carbon fiber body panels, a lithium ion battery, and a polycarbonate rear window. And you can actually have it come in under 900 kilos, which is really, really cool. Sitting at the very top of the tree, and I know you've actually experienced a few Lotuses, Mandy, so I'm curious to see what you think about the sound of these. But the top spec final edition car is the Exige Cup 430. It's got 321 kilowatts and 440 newton meters for a car that weighs just over a ton. and it makes 171 kilowatts of downforce when you're going flat out. It's like a collection of all of Lotus's coolest options. It's got carbon fiber everything. It's got a one-piece tailgate. It's got a rear wing with a Union Jack on the end of it, because of course it does. And because it's the Cup and not the Exige Sport, it's even got a more aggressive front steering geometry, so it turns in more sharply, which I think is a criticism of the Sport that I've read. It sort of handles like a BMW X7 usually, so that is a really welcome upgrade.
What did you think of the green one I saw on the story, J-Wo?
Oh, anything green and British I love. So, you know, don't tempt me with a good time, but yeah, they've now done so many special editions in these colors, and I think this metallic apple green, which looks very similar to like the Viper green that we see on Volkswagen and Audi products. It's great. It's great. I think all English cars should be in a form of green with like a brown interior and British flags all over it. Because why not?
If J-Lo ruled the car world.
Yeah, exactly right.
So, Mandy, you've driven a few Lotuses at Bathurst, no less, which sounds like an awesome day out. What was your experience of them? Because everything I've read and heard, Alborz owns one, is really positive, but I'm yet to drive one, which is something I plan on fixing this year, hopefully. What are they like?
Well, sadly, I only got the chance to drive Alborz's Lotus, but I got to speak to people who owned Evoras and Exiges, and they love them. In fact, I remember speaking to one lady who daily drove an Evora, and she has kids, and there
That's
was
fantastic.
Like kids stuff inside the car, and she races it over a weekend. And yeah, these people are very passionate about the cars and how practical and comfortable they are for everyday use. The Elise, driving that around Bathurst, was incredible. The sound is great. Obviously, you know, not as nice as like a V6 or a V8 or anything like that, but it's a pure driving experience because you're very low in the car, and the gear changes, the open gear. I don't know what you call it, like the synchro working
of it. On the gear shift.
The linkage, that's the word I was thinking of. Yeah, that's probably one of my favourite features of the Elise. So I think it's a great little thing. Oh, that wraps up news for this week. If you would like to know more, hit the Car Expert site and click the news link if you want to know more. Hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner.
I am very keen to hear you talk about a Australian company, well, actually in Melbourne, who is making Land Rovers or old ones into electric cars. Tell us more.
Exactly. So this is a company called Jaunt, which I think is a great name for a company. Basically, they've been around for a couple of years. They've recently moved from the Melbourne suburb of Coburg to a bigger little, it's still quite a small factory, but bigger than it was, in Williamstown in the inner west of Melbourne. And the business is basically buying up old series Land Rovers, and they've got one Defender as well, but they're mostly focused on series Land Rovers. And as you know, when you go out to the country, every farm seems to have about five of them sitting, you know, out in a paddock somewhere, so they're not hard to find. They take electric car components and make them EVs. They're doing this in a number of ways. So they're currently engineering a few different approaches. At the moment, they're using old repurposed Tesla batteries that are sourced from the United States. And they're using a lot of electric car architecture that they've sourced locally. They've actually just hired a guy who was a very senior engineer in quality control at Holden on the VF program, and then moved over to Solihull in the UK and led the Land Rover Velar factory development. So he has real experience in that sort of taking a company and I guess commercializing the product. So they've hired him. They've hired about 10 other sort of tinkerers and engineers and mechanics and all sorts of people to kind of help populate the company. And they're working on about five or six vehicles as we speak, and they're booked out until about the middle of 2022 at the moment. So essentially, this is a completely beautifully, immaculately restored classic Land Rover, a series Land Rover, in either two-door or four-door, or short or long wheelbase, I should say, to be more correct. Topless, fully electrified underneath, but looks completely authentic above. It even still retains the old four-on-the-floor gearbox, so of course you don't need to use the clutch because it doesn't have what you would conventionally call a manual gearbox as such. But it's still rugged, it's still off-road capable. Everything has been designed with an eye to make this hose-outable. And at the moment, you know, they're really just sort of working out what the market for vehicles like this is going to be. They're working with a couple of wineries who have actually bought vehicles. They've had a lot of expressions of interest from people who are really, I guess, saying, I love the idea of an EV, but there's nothing that appeals to me. And this is where they kind of hope to come in. And there's a real, I guess, community around the world now of small companies that are repurposing classic cars as EVs. Jaunt is by no means the only company doing things like this, and it's a great little community around the world that we're seeing. What I love, though, is that this is providing Australian jobs for Australian automotive engineers and techs, and, you know, providing an opportunity that wouldn't otherwise be there. And it does show that even at a small scale, high-tech, very complex things can be created and manufactured in Australia.
Mike, the series Land Rover is a long way removed from a Tesla. How much work actually has to go into making a battery fit in the chassis and making it not fall apart when you put all that torque to the road?
Yeah, so they basically strip it down just to the bare bones, which is the chassis rails, and they embed battery, depending on the spec of battery that you order. You can obviously have different capacity batteries depending on how much you want to pay and how far you want to drive. They put batteries under where the engine would go, and also down the side of the vehicle in the chassis. And then obviously the sort of transmission unit, and that sits up the front as well. Then all the panels are essentially sandblasted back and made brand new and put back on the vehicle. All new electrical systems internally, all new power steering system, rejigged suspension. So the bones of the vehicle are there, but it's essentially a new vehicle under a familiar skin, which I think, you know, they've really been quite keen to make it feel like a classic Land Rover. They don't want it to feel like a sophisticated computer on wheels to drive. They want it to still feel a bit like an old Land Rover, but just a little bit quicker, a little bit quieter, won't leak oil all over your driveway, obviously plugs into a wall rather than at a servo. So the process has been quite difficult. You know, when I went to the factory, there was four or five series Land Rovers in various states of being taken apart. And the issue is a lot of these parts do need to be custom built, custom fabricated. And the challenge that they've got at the moment is working out how they can scale it up and how they can put in place consistent processes that apply to each vehicle, rather than tackling each vehicle as a bespoke build, because until you get that nailed, you can't really scale the business. But this is very much it looks like a familiar car on the outside, but on the inside, it's a totally different beast.
Did Jaunt say how long it would take to build one of these cars?
Yeah, you're looking at a few months for a build. So right now they've got a handful of orders, and that's going to take them out for the rest of this year. Of course, as they scale up, their plan is to be able to do things much more quickly because they want to be able to, I guess, have some consistency in what they do, have some processes introduced that they currently don't have that would hopefully allow them to scale up. But right now it's a fairly slow process. And I suppose, you know, the advantage of that is as a customer, you can kind of follow the journey. So they've got one on the road now that has just been going through the process of getting fully licensed. So obviously one of the big challenges has been dealing with the engineers that sign off and actually license this vehicle to be driven on the road, because there really isn't anything like it. And so the existing procedures and protocols in place for licensing a car don't necessarily apply to a retro EV'd old series Land Rover, you know. So it's kind of a brave new world and they're sort of carving a new path. But at the moment, it's a fairly slow process.
Mm. Very, very cool. Look forward to seeing them growing even more.
I think the cool thing about it for me is, you know, I don't think anyone pretends that Jaunt is going to become a major car maker, but I think what it is it's showing how these classic old beloved cars, and Mandy, you've obviously got a couple of old classics yourself, and the Beetle and the Porsche. There's going to become a time where old vehicles like this are not able to be driven on the road because they're going to be seen as pollutants. You know, they're not going to meet safety standards and they're not going to meet emission standards. And if you can find a way to repurpose these old designs and keep them relevant and allow them to continue to flourish, I think that's such a good thing. I mean, it would be a sad world if we had none of these classic Land Rovers getting around. And if a company can crack the code of how to make them environmentally friendly while keeping the old school charm, I'm here for it. So I kind of wish him all the best.
Yep, totally agree with you there, Moco. And now, while you were here, I know Scully took part in this as well. You took a Jeep Gladiator to the Werribee four-wheel drive centre in Melbourne, and you said that you removed the doors.
Yes.
Did you do this purposely?
Indeed, we did. So we did a couple of projects during the week, one of which was, we hired out our friends at a 4x4 centre just out of Melbourne, which we use quite regularly. We had a number of pickup trucks or utes, depending on where you come from, down there for various tests. I'm doing a comparison at the moment between two massive man toys, the Ford Ranger Raptor and the Jeep Gladiator. The Jeep Gladiator, of course, being the Wrangler pickup. And, you know, they're not exactly what you'd call technical rivals, but they're both $75,000-ish silly pickup trucks that are more about, you know, the experience and the image than they are about the work. One of the great things about the Gladiator and what it has as a complete USP, I guess, in the market is it's designed to have the windscreen dropped down, the roof panels removed, and then all the doors taken off. And so you end up with a 5.6-metre long pickup truck with no doors and no roof and a windscreen folded down like an old Willys. We knew that this was something that you could do and that the car was designed to handle it. And it was actually Paul who said, well, we've got to do this and we've got to do a little time-lapse video on it and follow the progress. And Scully, you're in a much better place to tell the story. But you and Paul were the two guys with just a couple of hand tools that set about doing this. Was it a complicated procedure, Scully, would you say, or was it quite easy?
I wouldn't say it was complicated. Jeep has very clear instructions and everything, I mean, on most modern cars, all the hinges and stuff are hidden. On the Jeep, you can see them all. So it's quite obvious what you need to do, but just because it's simple doesn't mean it's easy. we were quite tight for time and I did warn Paul going in, I've taken the roof off a Wrangler before. I said, this is going to take us longer than we expect. He said, no, it'll be easy. And our little time-lapse turned into about a 45-minute time-lapse.
Wow.
Because there are a lot of screws to undo, which is reassuring because you don't want the roof or the doors flying off on the move. You start by unclipping a little like targa top almost directly above the driver and passenger and they just come straight off. And then there are, I think, about five screws around the back of the cabin and another couple at the front on top of the car to hold the roof in place. And you take all of those out and the roof lifts off with two people. It's quite light. And then you have to unscrew the windscreen wipers and take the windscreen wipers off and unscrew the windscreen from inside the car. And that just folds down and rests on some rubber sort of grommets on the bonnet. The doors were the trickiest bit, I think, purely because we didn't want to scratch the car for one, but also there's only one hand tool and there's two quite, you know, tightly wound screws holding each door in place, plus a hinge on the inside you've got to undo, and a wiring harness. And although Paul trained as an engineer and I am the world's, like, I'm the world's least practical man, I freely admit, neither of us is an actual real life automotive engineer, and neither of us has taken the doors off a car before. So there was quite a learning curve there of just what actually was required and how much time was required and all of that. But yeah, I think for two blokes like Paul and I who aren't off-roaders and aren't, you know, people who build stuff very often, to take it all apart in 40 minutes, and we put it back together faster than that, mostly because we were meant to be meeting Alborz, JWO, Igor and Mike for dinner, and our dinner was getting cold. So that is always a good motivator to really make you hurry up. But putting it together was easier because I think we'd done it before. But yeah, it realistically is a two-person job. It's not the sort of thing you'd do on a nice morning before a quick drive to the cafe, because it does take a lot of time. But if you live somewhere with nice weather, or you've got a garage with the space to stow the panels and keep the car undercover, it's a pretty unique experience driving around with no doors, no windscreen, no roof on it. It's the most sort of immersive convertible you can imagine.
Well, this is exactly it, isn't it, Scully? And, you know, it's funny. I remember when we had Simon there, our 4x4 editor as well, who's, you know, an absolute, you know, master when it comes to all things off-roading. And we were doing the Raptor versus the Gladiator, and the Raptor was more impressive on the road. Its interior felt a bit, you know, more spacious and better packaged. It was more comfortable on the road. It just seemed to sort of tick more boxes, I guess. It's got a better crash rating. But then, you know, the Gladiator, once you've done all those things like taking the doors and the roof and the windscreen off, it totally comes into its own, and you're kind of compelled to forgive it for all of its flaws, because this is a very flawed vehicle. And yet you do that to it and suddenly it just becomes your favorite thing in the world, which I guess is kind of what Jeep's all about, right?
It definitely can do things no other car can do, which is appealing. And it looks like nothing else on the road. It draws attention like very few other things on the road, for better or for worse. But yeah, we post a few cars on our Car Expert Instagram, but also on our personal ones. And I've posted pictures of supercars, of all sorts of things. And what got the most responses from people was a photo of a Jeep with all its roof and doors off. People going, partly going, that looks really cool, and partly going, why the hell would you bother with that? Which is also a fair question.
Well, I saw you last night, just as we left dinner, you were being accosted by a couple of blokes in an old patrol, asking you 101 questions about the Jeep, which I guess sort of says a lot about the target audience, right?
Absolutely.
Did you guys take it off road? And if you did, how did it actually feel? How did the chassis feel, I should say?
Yeah, so we did. So it's a mid-level course that we use. It's got a fair variety, from offset moguls to woodlog, slippery woodlog climbs, to a very steep and rutted trail, some high-speed suspension workouts over real choppy corrugations, some water crossings. So, you know, some sort of stuff that you're going to be throwing at a car like this. Now, we didn't have the full-on Rubicon one, which has double diff locks and a disconnectable front sway bar and all sorts of off-road gizmos. This was the stripped-back one. But a lot of 4x4 people would buy this because they prefer to buy aftermarket stuff, custom-made stuff, and then fit it to the vehicle. Now, it did very, very well. The fact that it doesn't even have a locking rear diff is quite amazing. It scrabbled up despite having, you know, sort of all-terrain, not proper off-road tyres. Most things, it had plenty of articulation with the solid axles and the coils at each end. Obviously, your visibility out of it is fantastic, because you've got that bluff nose with a fantastic approach angle and very thin pillars, so you can always see where you're going. But the problem with it is probably its sheer size. It's absolutely enormous, 5.6 meters long, huge wheelbase, and the breakover angle is very limited. So when you're coming up a sharp angled ascent and then you plateau out onto flat ground, we found once or twice we had a scrape of the underbelly just because it's so long, and it's a sort of problem you'd never find with a more wieldy short wheelbase Wrangler. Obviously, you know, if you were really hardcore, you'd probably be buying the Rubicon, or you'd be, you know, buying some awesome off-road add-ons like the double locking discs, like the front sway bar disconnect, all these sorts of things, putting some proper mud plugging tires on it. But for an out-of-the-box entry-level, you know, ute, it's still fantastic off-road. And to be honest with you, if a Wrangler-based vehicle wasn't fantastic off-road, you'd be bloody concerned.
Been a great chat, Mike Costello. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Scully, you've been driving the Audi Q5. I'd love to know your first impressions on this little SUV.
First impressions were like pretty much any Audi at the moment. Oh, that looks pretty sharp, because they've done a really good job with the facelift. Audi's got a really distinct design language, and I have heard it criticized previously for being a bit dull, and I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think the pre-update Q5 was handsome without being particularly exciting, but there's a whole lot of little things they've done to this car that make it look more like a Q7. I think it looks really sharp from the outside now. And then, of course, you open the door and you sit and you go, oh, this all feels really nice as well, because it's an Audi and they're built like that.
Mm, beautiful. So what prices are we looking at?
So the car we tested was a 40 TDI Launch Edition, which is the most expensive version of the cheapest Q5. So pricing kicks off at $68,900 before on-road costs for the 40 TDI Quattro, but the car that we tested is priced from $78,300 before on-roads. And then when you add the options that were fitted to our car, you're looking at $87,160 before on-roads. So it's an expensive version of the cheapest engine, but you do get some really cool stuff for that. On top of the standard kit you get in every Q5, and it's really quite generous. Audi has really decided, I think, to crank up the value as it chases BMW and Mercedes-Benz. So the whole range gets a good spread of kit, but the Launch Edition gets some really nice stuff like metallic paint, 20-inch wheels, a black exterior package, carbon fiber on the exterior mirrors, and it's real carbon. It's not fake trim stuff.
Yes.
Privacy glass and a massive panoramic sunroof. It's a really, really huge sunroof. It's sort of more convertible than sunroof or like the little portholes you get in some cars, which is good. You also get black or rock-colored leather seats inside with contrast stitching, extended leather trim for the doors and that sort of thing. And some extra interior ambient lighting. So you definitely get some extra stuff, but once you add the options that were fitted to our car, which is stuff like the digital OLED tail lights that you can change the pattern of, you don't need to option those. They're $2,500. And the Technic package was the big one at $5,000, which gives you LED matrix headlights and a 3D sound system, among other things. It did get quite expensive. If I was buying it, I'd avoid those option packs and just take it as is, because Audi's done a good job speccing the car.
So, Scott, you've spoken about the cosmetic changes already, but are there any like technical or mechanical changes that come with the facelifted car?
So Audi has been pretty thorough with the overhaul of this car. We're used to talking about facelifts that are just that. They're a little nip and tuck. They might get different LED light lenses or indicators or something like that. This car has got a pretty heavily redone interior. Because Audi has moved from a system that used a little click wheel on the transmission tunnel like BMW iDrive to a touch-based system since the Q5 launched, there's a new 10.1-inch touchscreen on the dashboard, and the controller is gone from the transmission tunnel. You also get the really excellent 12.3-inch virtual cockpit, which replaces the traditional analog dials with a screen that I still think is the best in the business, the Audi one. It's got the most customization, it's got the clearest mapping, and it's just so fast. It's really easy to see why Audi has taken the lead on all the Volkswagen Group software development, because all the tech in modern Audis is so sharp and so easy to use. They're the big interior updates you'll notice. There's also wireless charging and some other spec changes that are expected in 2021 that weren't necessarily expected in 2017 when the car launched. Under the skin, the engines have been updated as well. The 40 TDI now gets a 12-volt mild hybrid system, which doesn't sound all that impressive when you can get 48-volt systems, but it does have quite a smooth start-stop system. And if you lift off the accelerator at certain speeds, when you're approaching a set of lights, for example, or coming up to a junction, it can cut the engine out but keep the car's electronics going, so you get more efficient coasting on the highway. Power and torque are up as well. You get from this car 150 kilowatts and 400 newton meters, which is a decent little bump on the pre-update car. But the fundamentals of the Q5 and the size of it, the way it looks and the way it drives haven't changed too much.
Scully, what do you think the rivals are to the Q5?
So the big rivals for this car are the Mercedes-Benz GLC and the BMW X3. The Germans have had the luxury market to themselves for quite a while. I know that Lexus does also take them on, but the NX is priced a little differently to the Q5 and sized a little differently. It's not quite a perfect head-to-head, whereas, I mean, it should come as no surprise to hear that Audi, Mercedes and BMW tend to follow each other quite closely with that sort of thing. So the entire Q5 range has been updated, and there's different matches across different parts of each range there. But for the 40 TDI we have on test here, you're looking at the BMW xDrive 20D, the X3. It's about $4,000 more expensive, the Audi, but it does come with more kit. And then the base Mercedes GLC is petrol only. Mercedes actually doesn't have a pure diesel competitor for the Q5, but it does do a range of petrol engines and plug-in hybrids at this point now as well. So I think although there's differences on paper in terms of the pricing, if you were to walk into an Audi dealership and say, I'm looking at an X3, they would all of a sudden become very, very friendly, and maybe that pricing would change.
So, Scully, I suppose we should ask you how it drives.
So it drives like you would expect a mid-sized Audi SUV to drive, which I realize is a lazy description, but it is very, very competent and comfortable. Even though this car is on big wheels, it rides really nicely. In the city especially, it soaks up the world around you, and there's no big hard whacks over potholes or bumps. It kind of just irons the road out. And as you go faster, that gets smoother again. It's a really nice highway cruiser. The 40 TDI engine is good. I know that is also a lazy description, but it kind of sums that engine up because it's perfectly punchy for in the city. And when you're cruising on the highway, it's really, really relaxed and quiet in the background. It's also very efficient in the real world. Audi claims 5.4 litres per 100 kilometres on the combined cycle. We saw 7.6, which is obviously not the same as what Audi claims, but it is still very impressive for a big car. I know it's a mid-size SUV, but none of these are light cars anymore. And we drove it in the city. There was some really hard driving as well out in the hills outside Melbourne, and then a highway cruise. So it is efficient. And once you're on the highway, it's really quite settled and comfortable and quiet. It just does lack a little bit of punch if you really load it up and want to go overtaking on the highway. And at the price of the launch edition, as we tested it, it's only $2,000 cheaper than the 50 TDI. And the 50 TDI is a six-cylinder engine, and it has significantly more power and torque. It's got 60 kilowatts and 220 newton meters more, along with a more sophisticated mild hybrid system. So although this engine is fine, and I think it makes a lot of sense in the base car priced at $67,000 or around that area, as you get up towards $90,000, you can get a lot more engine in your Q5. The other thing worth mentioning is we haven't driven the 45 TFSI, which is the entry-level petrol engine, and it has quite similar outputs to the diesel, powers up and torques a little bit down as you'd expect. But I have a sneaking suspicion that for day-to-day driving around the city, it's going to be a slightly friendlier engine. And if you want to push it a bit harder, it's going to rev and make a nicer noise. So the diesel does a good job at sort of chugging along on the highway, and it's super refined, super smooth. But I think that at the entry level, and we're going to have to confirm this, obviously, it's going to be worth looking at the petrol as an alternative. And if you're getting towards launch edition money, I mean, I'm a sucker for a big, torquey diesel engine. And the idea of 220 newton meters more and a more upmarket mild hybrid system is pretty appealing. So the engine is good, but whether it's quite as good as the other engines in the range, I'm not quite sure yet.
So the car expert rating, Scott Colley gave the Q5 was good.
Yes, correct. Good out of 10.
What actually was the rating you gave it?
So it's a 7.9, which is a strong rating, obviously. What dragged it down a little bit was value for money, because the car that we tested was quite expensive and knocking on the door of a more powerful, better spec'd version that got marked down. I think the sort of people who buy these launch edition cars also maybe don't care that you can get the more powerful one, because I think there's only about 180 of these coming to Australia with a diesel engine. There's 400 in total. So the sort of the value for money thing, if you are buying purely on a rational basis, well, you would wait for the 50 TDI to arrive and take that for a drive. But the appeal of the launch edition also is that it looks really cool. It's got the carbon fiber mirrors and a whole lot of extra stuff. So I can see the appeal in it, but on a value for money basis, it just doesn't quite stack up to the 50 TDI.
You can read more in detail of that review. It's now live up at the website. That brings an end to this week's podcast. What sort of cars have we got coming up next week, Joe?
So next week, we've got a few cars in. We've got the updated Audi Q5 45 TFSI Quattro Sport. That's a bit of a tongue twister that Scott wasn't able to trial at the launch. So we've got that coming in next week. We also have a SsangYong Musso Ultimate, The short tray version as opposed to the XLV long tray version that we've got in this week. We've also got a Mercedes-AMG GLA 35, and then we've got a Kia Sorento GT line and Volkswagen Touareg 170 TDI in for comparison. And that's pretty much it for now.
What are you driving?
I don't know what I'm driving next week. We're very on the fly here. This weekend, well, the weekend just passed by the time this publishes, I will have finished up driving in the Mercedes-Benz A250 4MATIC sedan, which I have been enjoying, and I feel like it suits my personality and vibe very much. And where I live in Doncaster, there is a lot of them. So
right.
I fit right in, which is great.
Very nice. I look forward to reading that review. Scully, I noticed a really cool comparo that Moco has done between the Macan and the X3.
Yeah, so Mike has taken a Macan GTS and a BMW X3 M40i, two very different takes on a fast sort of mid-sized SUV, and put them side by side. We took them out to photograph them last week, and it's amazing how the Porsche looks like a hatchback on stilts, essentially. The Macan is quite squat. It's got a very sloping roof, whereas the X3 is upright with massive windows. It almost looks like a bus next to the Macan, but both of them are fast. Both of them are fairly practical, although one is more practical than the other. I actually can't tell you which wins because I don't know. Mike hasn't told me yet, but I think it'll be a good bit of content nonetheless because they're very interesting cars to put side by side.
Yeah. That's an interesting comparison. All right. That's it. James Wong and Scott Colley, thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.
You noticed I said your name first, Jay Ware?
Yes, I did.